know nothing about science fiction. Some people accuse me of living in such a world. And we'll get to that later, actually. Speaking of Tommy's mother and my own mother, I think if you ask most people about biological diversity, biodiversity, they tend to say that's a good thing, we're in favor of it, and they talk about whales and panda bears. It's very hard to get people beyond that to talk about intraspecies diversity. If you ask them about the diversity within species, the common person is probably, let's see if I can get this to work, maybe it's this, is going to be thinking about different breeds of dogs.
Just hit the left side here.
Okay. There are about 400 different breeds of dogs in the world, 165 recognized by AKC, and that seems to be what most people, about as far as most people's knowledge of diversity within species goes. But if you really press them, they do understand that there's some diversity out there, and they see the different colors of beans in the supermarket and such, so they know that there are a number of different varieties of beans, but in fact, they don't really know beans about carrots. And what they don't really understand at all is that our gene banks are full of accessions. In the case of rice, some 80 to 100,000 different accessions, probably somewhere in the same neighborhood for wheat. But that what you see on the screen there is not seven different samples, it's actually one, because collectors will be collecting in a field, in this case a single farmer's field in Tajikistan, and this will constitute a population which then gets entered into the gene bank as one accession. Of course, the other way to look at diversity is not just the visual colors, like the nice colors of beans or carrots, but to recognize that our different crop varieties are adapted to widely different conditions, from Ethiopia to Iceland, for example. Now I want to show you three different slides that really together, I think, sum up the situation that I think exists globally with what passes for our global system for conserving plant genetic resources. I use that word pretty loosely because we don't really have a system yet. Earlier this year, I was in Australia, and someone there said to me, well, Kerry, you know, you're talking about a global system and the need to support gene banks around the world, but we have a pretty good gene bank here for wheat. We have a lot of wheat accessions, so why should we be worried about what's happening in the rest of the world? And I said, well, you know, on an accession basis, do you realize what percentage of the global total of conserved accessions you have in your gene banks? And this fellow said, well, no, actually, I don't. I said, well, you've got 3%. So if you're content with basing the future of the Australian wheat industry on 3% of the world's wheat accessions, be my guest. How lucky do you feel today? He instantly answered that he didn't feel that lucky. And my response was, well, this is very typical, and what it means is that we actually need a system that will ensure the conservation of material not just in our own country but in other countries and ensure its availability, because as you can see from this table, Australia has 3% of the accessions. That doesn't, by the way, indicate that they have 3% of the diversity. There's no way of measuring that. But the number 3 is really not that odd in this table. Most countries have relatively small percentages of the global total of accessions of whatever crop you want to mention. There, as far as I know, there have been 3 studies done to assess the extent to which the gene pools have been collected in the major crops. I was involved with the study on the far right. One of the other two, I can't remember which it is, was done by Judith Lyman at the Rockefeller Foundation, and is much better than the study I did in the mid-90s. But the interesting thing about this table, two things, I think. One is that the percentages are reasonably similar in all cases. and in almost all cases. And the second thing that I think is interesting is that the scientists typically believe that they have collected a fair amount of the diversity of our major crops, but it drops off pretty rapidly after that. Now, we were asking them the question that can't be answered. Let me be frank about that. You ask them how much of the diversity out there has been collected. The immediate answer is, well, how would I know? I don't know how much is out there. We say, yes, we understand you can't answer that question, but answer it anyway. I mean, if anybody can make a good guess, you're the one that makes the good guess. So we, in all three cases, scientists were surveyed. In the Judith Lyman case, I think 700 scientists were surveyed. We surveyed at FAO rather less than that, but still coming up with this figure. Now, what this means, of course, is that we have collected and conserved in gene banks a fair amount of the diversity of the major crops, but a good bit of the diversity of the minor crops is still out there in situ, which would seem to indicate that more collecting is called for, but collecting is not an easy thing to do these days because of politics and legal restrictions. And I think it also means that in a rapidly changing world and in a world in which there's no inventory or mechanism for access to genetic resources on farm in situ, that much of this diversity that's not in the gene banks of the of some of these crops is simply unavailable to plant breeders. Finally, if you can make out this slide, this is the slide that frankly guides us in our work at the Global Crop Diversity Trust. This slide shows the increase in number of accessions being stored in gene banks from the mid-80s to about 1996-97. You can see that in that space of time, gene banks went from storing about 2 million accessions to storing a bit over 6 million accessions. We're probably now at about 6.5 million accessions. There are actually two lines in this graph. The second one is hard to see because it's bumping along at the very, very bottom. And that is the cumulative number of accessions collected by the CGIAR during this period of time, collected in the field. Now, the CGIAR, I believe, is probably the world's largest, collectively speaking, the world's largest collector of germplasm. So you see that in this period of time, when gene banks went from storing 2 million accessions to storing 6.2 million accessions, that there was virtually no collecting in the field being done because of the politics. What that means is that the rise in numbers in gene banks from 2 million to over 6 million can only be explained by seed banks, gene banks trading materials amongst themselves, not by influxes of new materials. Now, you can say that's fine, and every gene bank has a right to assemble whatever it wants to and maintain whatever it wants to, but it's not quite that simple if you're looking at it from a global level. The FAO database has a listing of 1,400 different gene banks. I don't believe we can take care of 1,400. The mean there, by the way, around 700 gene banks would be a gene bank that's storing 2,500 accessions, which, by the way, is the size of some gene bank, national gene banks in some small developing countries. I don't believe we can maintain that kind of infrastructure. We can't keep the roof repaired on 1,400 facilities. And if I were to ask you how many good gene bank managers do you think there are in the world, how many good curators, I bet you wouldn't say 1,400. So the situation is rather grim, and it's revealed in things like regeneration statistics, where you have some countries reporting that their regeneration need is 50 to 100% of their collection. At the Trust, we're estimating the average regeneration need to be something like 50% in developing countries. If I want to continue to be pessimistic, I can look at the information system and tell you that most countries don't have good gene bank management software tools, and there's no global information system for plant breeders to search for the materials they need. And moreover, we're not producing, formally at least, many new good curators and managers. The one, I guess there's a new program in the Philippines, but the most famous graduate program at the University of Birmingham in the UK in plant genetic resources conservation has just closed down. Now I want to shift gears just for a second, because this is the kind of situation that we take into a climate-changing world, and I wanted to talk for a moment about that. This is a photograph I took a little bit earlier in the year. It's of a Norse church in Greenland. The point of this slide is that the last wedding ceremony in Norse Greenland was held here in this church in the year 1408. The Norse made one fatal mistake, and that was they didn't want to adjust to climate change. They decided that they wanted to continue to raise their cows on the local grass in Greenland, and it was getting much, much colder. They could have learned from the Inuit how to make kayaks and hunt in the sea and such. They didn't do that. And this slide reminds me that civilizations that don't choose to adapt to changing conditions are civilizations that end up like this. That raises the question of what we're going to be doing. Now, here are some histograms that were provided to me by Professor David Battisti at the University of Washington. They're rather better than the maps that I typically see, which I can't really comprehend. These histograms show two different things. They show the average temperature during the growing season in these countries for the last 100 years. Those are the purple or blue bars on the left. Then he's taken the mean of over 100 climate studies to construct the projected average growing season temperature for the year 2070 to 2100. And you'll see that in the bottom case, they don't even overlap for Australia. In other words, the hottest years of the past 100 years in Australia will be colder than the coldest growing season years from 2070 to 2100. Again, the mean of 100 studies. These two, I didn't pick out these countries because they make that particular point. If you look at developing countries, they're all pretty much the same. I know that there are projections coming out of Lawrence Livermore Lab, soon to be published, that all things remaining equal, what this will produce is about a 20% or 25% decrease in maize production in southern Africa, even as soon as 2030, unless we can have varieties that are adapted to this type of temperature situation. And finally, I'll give you an overview. This is a wonderful photograph from the satellite of Bangladesh. You can see, you get a sense of the relief there, and the white in the upper portion, that's not clouds, that's snow and ice in the Himalayas. The temperatures that are projected for that area of the world, of course, will force that snow and ice to melt, and you can see from this photograph where it's going to go. The question then, I guess, is what are we going to do about it? And I want to spend just 2 minutes telling you what the Global Crop Diversity Trust is going to do about it. The trust is a relatively new international organization. We're established, we're structured as an endowment fund, a trust fund, generating income with the mandate of conserving unique plant genetic resources in perpetuity. What this means is that you first have to identify what that unique material is. You can't set up an entitlement program to conserve all 6.5 million samples in gene banks today, because 6.5 million today can be 13 million, 50 million, 100 million tomorrow. So we've have gone the route of assembling experts for individual crops and having them identify for us the most important collections in those particular crops. We are undertaking a massive campaign to regenerate those accessions in developing countries. We anticipate regenerating about 165,000 samples in the next 4 years. We are working with the USDA on a germplasm gene bank management software system, and working Biodiversity International and USDA on a global system that will allow plant breeders to search through multiple gene banks, hundreds of gene banks, to find the accessions that they need. We're supporting basic research to develop more cost-efficient and more effective mechanisms for conserving hard-to-conserve crops, some of the roots and tubers and such. And then, of course, the point is to maintain these collections, and we'll use our endowment fund to do that. So that's the general way that the general approach that we have. I know you can't read this, but it's a kind of a decision tree that guides us and helps us to make rational decisions and not simply pass out money like someone would deal cards in a card game to everybody, but to focus our funding on collections that really add to the gene pool and are quite necessary. Now, in the couple of minutes that are left, I want to turn to something that's captured the attention of the media a good bit and tell you about what's happening near the North Pole. My gosh, it never occurred to me when I started work in this field that one would be ever be doing anything regarding agriculture or plant genetic resources near the North Pole, but that's the way it's turned out. Accidents happen. And here's where we're located. If you, let me just untether myself here. This is Oslo here, and this is the place I'm going to be talking about. If you fly from northern Africa to Oslo, you're halfway there. This is the farthest you can fly on a commercial plane in the world. Here's another map of it, and what you're looking at is Svalbard over on the right. A few shots of the terrain up there. I took these about 10 days ago. I'm not a great photographer, but the landscape is beautiful and you can't screw up. This is a huge glacier. It's probably 100 meters or so tall, so it's a long way down. This was from a helicopter. You can see there is global warming. That glacier is being pushed out and it's falling off. But it's still quite cold. Still some shots. There's a small Norwegian village called Longyearbyen there. It's Longyearbyen at night. And the facility that we're going to talk about is just around the corner on the left. I know this looks like a James Bond set. maybe someday it will be. Let me stop here and say that a number of people have been involved in this project, and one of the key people, absolutely indispensable, and who's been working on this is sitting right in the back, and it's Henry Shands. So Henry, this couldn't have been done without you. You know that. Henry was a member of the feasibility team and really got the ball rolling on thinking through both the design and the management of this facility. Basically, the idea here is to have a fail-safe facility which can be a backup for existing seed banks. Seed banks, gene banks are vulnerable. They're in buildings, and buildings are vulnerable to all kinds of things, from natural disasters and the roof falling and fires and everything else.
Okay.
In the past couple of years, we've had gene banks destroyed in Iraq and Afghanistan. We had major damage to the National Gene Bank in the Philippines last year during a cyclone. There are a lot of problems. Here, you'll see the idea is to build into the permafrost. The tunnel that's going into the mountain is going to be about 125 meters long. In the back, you'll have three vault-like rooms. I'm going to show you a picture in a minute. each capable of storing about 1.5 million samples. By the way, 1.5 million would be our estimate of how many unique samples there are in the world after all of this gene bank inflation took place. So plenty of room to grow, and in the back it's -4 Celsius permafrost. Calculations for climate change are that it will be below freezing 200 years from now. This is a pretty secure facility. We'll take advantage of the permafrost and lower it down to -18 mechanically. Here it is. This is not science fiction. This is actually happening. This photograph was taken about 10 days ago from a helicopter. There it is, the seed vault in situ. Another picture of it, give you a little bit sense of scale there. This is in the tunnel at the back of the seed vault, looking up towards the front. And here's one of the vault rooms. This is a room that's about 27 meters long by 10 meters wide, about 5 meters tall. This facility will open 26th of February next year. Storage will be for unique material. It will be free of cost. The trust is working with developing countries and international centers to send their material there. Basically, what we want to do is put an end to extinction of crop diversity taking place ex situ when accidents, civil wars, strife, etc., get in the way. We believe that putting together all of these pieces is what we really need to do, have to do, to construct a global system, a real global system that's rational, that's effective, that's efficient, and that's sustainable. And therefore, we believe that we can actually solve this particular world problem in our lifetime, and by doing so, can contribute quite dramatically to solving the other problems that are so much in the papers today of climate change, water, and energy problems. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. We literally have about 1 minute if you want to squeeze in a question or two maybe, and then we'll go on to the next speaker, and then we'll have time at the end, so I'm asking the speakers to stay. Fran?
Your slide on the hyperinflation.
Okay, the question is, how does the slide about the sort of hyperinflation in gene bank holdings relate to the previous slide about the percentage? Well, I mean, I know that a number of gene banks have been established even in the last couple of years purely by sending, collecting these days in many cases, frankly, being done by email and postcard. And so their entire gene banks, I won't name names, but I talked with the director of a gene bank a couple of months ago who told me that he had collected 30,000 accessions in the last 2 years. I was astonished. I said, my gosh, in your country? He said, no, from the CGIR, from Fort Collins, from and this country had essentially established a gene bank based on material that they had brought in from everyone else. To me, this is completely irrational if what you're doing is establishing a gene bank for long-term conservation, because the material is already available. So why would you want to set up a system where you have to pay to maintain something that's already available? We're not talking about breeders' collections or active collections, but long-term conservation. So I don't know how it works out across the board, but we have a huge amount of unintended duplication in the system. And more importantly, we have particularly a lot of poor countries, developing countries, that are paying money that they can't afford to pay to have conservation systems that are frankly less than adequate to conserve material that's not being used.